Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. I'm your host, Isaac Weisop. Today we're in the Grey Lodge. We will focus. We're finally getting into it, okay? We're going to get into the Twin Peaks pilot episode, Northwest Passage, aka Season 1, Episode 0. So first we're going to walk through the episode, discuss the highlights, and begin to explore some of the occult symbolism and hidden or not so hidden messages of Twin Peaks. Starting off with the credits. Even just the credits connects us into the hermetic view of nature versus mankind and symbolism of Wizard of Oz throughout, of course. And from there, you know, in the conclusion, we're going to wrap up. We're going to readdress how there's these recurring themes in Twin Peaks of duality. And in the pilot, you see there's just tons of symbolism you're going to find throughout this whole series, okay? The ceiling fan, the all-seeing eye, I mean, it's all here. And in the conclusion, we're going to deep dive into the symbolism of Harry Truman and how that actually plays a major role here with a shocking connection to Julie Cruise's Nightingale song. That's a banger of a find that I tracked down here. And look, there are Twin Peaks is a massive cult-followed topic. There have been countless books, podcasts, YouTube videos, theories out there already. So much so that I almost hesitated to even go this route. But nonetheless, this is what we're going to do. Because shockingly, I haven't looked very hard, to be honest, but I didn't see any books out there that devoted themselves to the occult messaging of Twin Peaks. You'll find podcast books, YouTubes that will mention some of these ideas. Our focus is going to be the occult symbolism and messages of the whole show. And I don't know how much new information I can provide that's not already out there. So there might be some people that are so into Twin Peaks that they've been watching the show for 30 years and they're not going to be that impressed, possibly. But I do think I found a unique and new finding already. Okay. Because my only resources I've used to look into this show, besides watching it like I do with my own film analysis, I watch it a couple times, take a bunch of notes, dig into things, right? I started listening to the Diane podcast, and it's really good. But they kind of fall into that camp of they go through the show, and they mostly are sort of, I don't know, film critic geeks. And every now and then, they'll drop a nice little occult tidbit on there, primarily tarot focused, which is good, but that's not what we're doing. We're going all in on this thing, right? So anyway, you're going to have to listen to the conclusion. I'm going to tie Julie Cruise's Nightingale to President Harry S. Truman, aka Sheriff Harry Truman, Majestic 12, Freemasonry. It's all there, right in front of us. And even a connection to the Twin Peaks, the ring, the jade ring, the symbol on the ring, the symbol of the Twin Peaks show ties into all those things. Yes, Majestic 12, the Nightingale, Truman, all of it. So we're gonna cover a lot today. All right, this is going to be one of the longer episodes of my Grey Lodge series, only for the supporters, because you deserve the best. Quick little background info on the pilot. It was filmed for $4 million with the agreement that ABC, who aired the show, that they would shoot an additional ending so they could sell it in Europe as an entire film if the pilot didn't get picked up as a TV show. I've heard that the European version film is available, that somehow you can watch it. I don't know. I haven't seen it. Again, I'm pretty new to Twin Peaks. I'm brand new. I watched this pilot twice. There's people that have seen this thing hundreds of times. So, yes, there's going to be a lot that I miss. There's going to be a lot that doesn't make the cut. A lot of classic scenes that might not even be mentioned on here. But that's not my place, okay? I'm trying to get you in and out at a reasonable time Clean and a reasonable price is what I'm trying to get you out at here. Now, fun fact, the series, so the pilot is called Northwest Passage because the series was originally set to be titled Northwest Passage and set in North Dakota. I read that they had to change it because there's a real town named Northwest Passage, which I believe is in Washington. So anyway, they changed it up. Thank goodness they did. The first episode is directed by David Lynch, because you'll find that season one and two, Lynch only directed a few episodes. Various other directors kind of stepped in for different episodes. But the show was written by Mark Frost and David Lynch. As I've described before, I feel like Mark Frost is the occult mastermind, and David Lynch is the master of subconscious, emotional sort of connection there. It was the show, the pilot was released April 8th, 1990. And it's a real bummer I wasn't there for it. I feel really, really sad that I'm new to this Twin Peaks world. I was 10 years old at the time. And if I recall, I was very obsessed with, you know, WWF wrestling or NWA or WCW wrestling back in the day. And I was getting into hip-hop at the time, you know, Madonna, Dick Tracy. I love Dick Tracy. The movie came out that year. And as you know, I didn't get to see it until I was 42 years old or whatever, 43. you probably heard that sob story. So anyway, let's get into the show. Also, follow me on Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt, because I'm going to put images about what we're discussing on not only this episode, but every episode I ever do, including the Grey Lodge episodes and all that. All right, episode zero, the credits. Just the credits alone is going to take a chunk of time to get through, all right? I've watched them countless times. They start out with a bird, an iconic bird, and it fades into a smokestack. Now, this bird is what they call a Bewick's wren, which is apparently native to where they filmed Twin Peaks. And I got to figure out how to say the name Snoqualmie, Washington, because I'm probably going to say it 100 more times. But now, here's my thing. If you look at the credits the right way, and I'll try to put this on. Let me make a note here. I'll try to put this on the Instagram of what I'm talking about. There's like this transitional thing, and I'm a little half delusional about it. But it goes from the bird to this smokestack, then into this machinery kicking off sparks, all right? If you watch it from a certain perspective, it looks like we're going from the bird to a detonation of an atomic bomb. That's the claim I'm going to make. If you look at it in the right sort of way, you kind of see it. And I'll put the images because it's easier to show you than to discuss this. Because I do think there's a theme here of nature versus mankind versus technology. And we're going to come back to that in a second. Because throughout the throughout the credits, you'll see these woodworking tools. Presumably, we're at Packard's sawmill, but it's kind of a dark vibe though, because they're playing this sort of chill soap opera moody music. Yet you see these sharpened blades just cutting and tearing up stuff. Right? It's like this dark, deadly force coming through to tear up this town. Because the power tools are very violent, they're very dangerous, it's very kinetic. They induce anxiety. So, and the idea I think it's presenting, just to sort of give you a preview of what we're talking about, I think they're trying to present the Ben Horn and the Packard sawmill sort of represent the capitalism destroying nature. The sawmill, of course, is sawing down trees. They're literally doing it. And Ben Horn is possessed by wealth and money and power. And he's trying to find a way to make the Ghostwood housing projects work. We're going to get into that, though, right? But that's why you see the bird juxtaposed to the smokestack. It shows the transition of nature to industrial mankind, whatever. Now, and we talked about the Ghostwood National Forest. You know, Ben Horn wants to build the Ghostwood Country Club on this land of this national forest. And this is where all the action is, right? At the Ghostwood National Forest. It's where the entrance to the Owl Cave will be. We'll find out about that. This pagan Gastonbury grove of sycamore trees. And we're going to get into all that. And because, like I said before, I have to play this dance, right? Because I don't want to spoil the plot of the show, because there's some people out there that are watching it while we go through the episodes. And there's some people that have seen it 100 times. So I'm trying to find a way. Like, I don't want to give away major plot spoilers. I'd give away mini plot spoilers. All right. So I'm going to try to balance that a little bit. And of course, Gastonbury Grove, a reference to King Arthur and a mystical burial location. And of course, as you will find out, the mystical Black Lodge. So we'll come back to that. Now, ironically, the Packard Sawmill. Well, that's another plot spoiler. We're going to hold off on that. You don't need to know this yet. but Ben Horn, right? He's the. We're still in the credits here, folks. The Ben Horn, he's possibly one of the biggest scumbags on the show. More so than some of these drug-dealing murderer types. And I think it's possible that Mark Frost, possibly David Lynch even, read Michael Hoffman's Secret Society's book. Because that's the vibe I get from the credits and the whole theme of mankind sort of destroying nature, okay? Let's read you from Michael Hoffman's book. The era of modern enthusiasts for what they regard as the magical, Merlin-esque, harmonious time of the Druids and Stonehenge is ignorant of the fact that the historical period they idolize was itself immersed in a tampering technology and materialism, which essentially marked a revolutionary break with the natural order. According to John Mitchell, the first revolution of Olympus marks the first deviation from the primeval ways of men presided over by Cronus, otherwise Saturn. Because you'll find Saturn symbolism throughout this show. This revolution marks the end of man's Edenic relationship with the natural world. Henceforward, man is alienated from nature by means of the Saturnian scythe, which symbolizes the sense of separation from God's natural creation that man experienced after the fall. Man began his peregrination away from Eden through his conceit that he would become as God. Yet as soon as he left the divine plan for the occult process, his stated objective became the Kabbalistic Tikkun Olam, or repair of the world, via the intervention and imposition of human brain power, the very egomaniacal device that caused the separation from God's natural Eden in the first place. Repair of the world, indeed, a world of Kabbalists, had only just ruined. After this Saturnian division, Hermetic man saw himself as separate and inevitably above nature, though always quick to identify himself as nature's benign shepherd. This mighty occult shepherd king figure has emerged in history under the forms of Arthur, Merlin, Pendragon, and Prester John. He is the personification of the manipulation of nature by secret technology on behalf of a secret hierarchy, if known at all, is always careful to present itself as the supreme friend of divine creation. If the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, that is to say the literal alteration of man's circumstance of living solely upon God's bounty and providence, was the result of satanic intervention, why has it not dawned on us that civilization is itself satanic? So, that's the vibe I get from the credits. And as I was reading, I was thinking about it, and I think that book was released after Twin Peaks was created. So, there goes that theory already. And like I said, this is a creative process. You're joining me as we I'm planning on writing a book with all these things. Let's see what happens if I run out of steam. I don't know. I can't promise you that. That's the plan, though. I'm approaching it as a research project to write the book, but it's such a massive project. The biggest one I've done yet. So that was one theory I had. I guess we can't say that Lynch read this book because that was released after. So, but similar ideas there, right? Now, the credit colors, they're bright and they're deep emerald. And my wife Josie said, hey, maybe that's the Wizard of Oz connection there. Because we were talking about Lynch's obsession with Wizard of Oz. And sure enough, there they are. Emerald colored credits. And you'll see that the Twin Peaks Sheriff Department also has a similar font on it. So anyways, a lot going on in the credits, right? We see the credits wrapping, and there's two ducks in the water. And I believe this is unique to the first, to the pilot episode only. Both of these ducks, they split up and they go in a different direction, right? Which is kind of interesting. And then, of course, the water shows us a heavy reflection, as above, so below kind of idea there. But you get duality right off the bat because you see the ducks sort of splitting off, and it goes right into, we're in a bedroom and there's two dog statues. Then from the dog statues, we see, we're introduced to Josie. And Josie is looking into the mirror, all right? Which you see the reflection. And we'll come back into the conclusion with this, but there's a Kabbalistic meaning in all this, and we're referring to Dayot as the hidden realm, and it's the reflection of Keter, the superconscious mind of God. So it's the inner dimension of Keter that man can somehow access. Now, Pete Martell, played by Jack Nance, he's going to go fishing. So he tells Catherine, I'm heading out to go fishing. Goes out there, we hear the lonesome foghorn blow, and he looks over next to this absolutely massive log. Must be the biggest log in existence. I thought it was a stone for a while, but no, it's this massive log. I mean, the thing must be what? I don't know. It looks like it's 20 feet in diameter. And in front of it, on the banks of the shore, the shoreline there, there's a dead person wrapped in plastic. And there's an almost ritual feel to it. You know, she's bound tight, wrapped in plastic, and next to this massive monolith of a felled tree. And we find out later it's at the dock by Packard Mill below the dam. So Pete, he calls Sheriff Harry Truman, the Secretary of the Sheriff's Department, Lucy Moran, which, I mean, her name is Moran, and they show you that, and it makes you think of moron. Are they trying to say she's a moron? Because her character is kind of aloof. But yeah, take a listen, because you're going to get possibly the most famous line from the whole Twin Peaks, and it's Pete Martell calling Sheriff Truman.
Morning, Pete. Harry.
She's dead. Wrapped in plastic.
Now, whoa, hold on. Hold on a second, Pete. Where? You stay right there. I'm on my way. Better get Dr. Hayward. Tell him to meet me up at the Packard Mill. The dock right below the dam. And roast that Andy out of bed. Tell him to get his butt up there now.
What is it?
We got a body up there. Lucy, not a word about this to anyone till you hear from me.
So this figure's wrapped in plastic. Sheriff Truman, Dr. Haywood, they go down to the bank, they open the plastic, they reveal Laura Palmer. My God, it's Laura. And Laura was, of course, the homecoming queen. She's only 17, so this is pretty horrific. Then they show Laura's mom. She's at home, Sarah Palmer. She's at home, and she's looking for Laura. She doesn't know she's dead yet. She's just missing. She said, where the heck is Laura, right? And you'll notice that they zoom in on the ceiling fan while she's running up and down the stairs looking for Laura. And you wouldn't realize that this is important at all. But this is critical to the storyline in Missing Pieces, which is yet another piece of Twin Peaks you got to watch. It's the, I believe it's the Fire Walk With Me deleted scenes. They call it Missing Pieces. We find out that this ceiling fan is tied into this horrific evilness. And there's a lot darker secrets, right? But Mom, Sarah Palmer, she calls Laura's boyfriend's house, Bobby Briggs. And they can't find Bobby either. So, you know, Leland and Sarah Palmer, they're both like, okay, you know, Laura's probably just with Bobby somewhere, right? Bobby, of course, you know, Johnny Football star, quarterback, amazing hair, charismatic. So next we go to the Great Northern Hotel, a hub of all Twin Peaks activity, season one and two. And there's business at hand. Leland Palmer, which is Laura's father, he's the lawyer. Benjamin Horn is the businessman. And they're trying to sell this project for the Ghostwood Country Club to some Norwegians as investors. And, you know, Ben Horn, he's got this inside information on the Packard sawmill going out of business. Kind of a subplot here. But let's talk about the symbolism of Ben Horn. First off, the name Horn, spelled H-O-R-N-E. And you could think of Horn as in the horns of the devil, or horny, because turns out he's a pretty horny guy. And his brother, who's not in the pilot, is Jerry Horn. So that's an interesting connection. We've got Ben and Jerry, which seems kind of silly. But every time you see Ben Horn, you'll notice, well, not every time, but oftentimes when they show Ben Horn, he's smoking a cigar and or he is by a fireplace. So there's another motif of fire and smoke that occurs oftentimes. I believe it's tied to the masculine principle. So Sarah Palmer, she can't find Laura. They can't find Bobby. She calls up Leland, who's trying to sell this project to the Norwegians. She interrupts the business meeting to ask if he knows where Laura is. Because Sarah knows something is wrong. She's got this intuition. A very feminine, goddess-like energy. And Leland's like, man, I don't know. She's probably just screwing around with Bobby somewhere. Meanwhile, Sheriff Truman pulls up to the hotel. And he's got a message for Leland. And it's not good. So now Sarah and Leland, they both know something terrible has happened when they see Sheriff Truman. A very painful sequence. They nail the horror of this scene perfectly, right? And when they tell Leland about them finding Laura's body, he drops the phone. And if you look at the way Lynch filmed this, he zooms in on the phone and pans down over the cord of this dropped phone. And I get vibes of the Descension of Consciousness, all right? And again, we can reference Wizard of Oz. Lynch said he thinks about Wizard of Oz every day. He's very obsessed with it, right? We did four episodes on the Wizard of Oz. And on those episodes, we talked about the horizontal material plane versus the consciousness ascension plane of the vertical. That's why the good witches are north and south and the bad witches are east and west. So it's almost like we're going vertically down the consciousness plane here. So we finally find out where Bobby is. Because he's spitting game to Shelley at the Double R Diner. He's not at football practice. He's not out running. He's not with Laura, who's his girlfriend. He's talking to Shelley. But Shelley Johnson is married to a truck driver, Leo Johnson. I believe Shelley is also 17, but she apparently dropped out of high school and she is working at the diner. But like I said, she's married to Leo Johnson, a truck driver. And we find out later Leo's very abusive, so we're okay with this situation, right? So Bobby, he's sneaking around with Shelley, but Norma, who owns the diner, she's on to it. She knows, again, that female intuition, that goddess intuition, she's got it. Much like you see in Eyes Wide Shut with Alice. She knows all. She's the knowing all Sophia. So Norma's on to the affair. And by the way, Norma's also got an affair going on too. Because this whole show is about duality. It's about sex. It's about death. Now, fun fact, there was a shot from the David Lynch website of old Twin Peaks photos. And one of them shows that there was a sign up in the Double R Diner called the Double R Special. And it's called the Douglas Fir Burger, which is clearly a sexual innuendo he placed in there with the Fir Burger, okay? Not to be crude. So, but I'm just trying to reiterate the point here. That's what the show is about. It's the same principles of the occult, the forces of nature, you know, Thanatos or the death drive versus Eros, the sex drive, the libido. All right. So now we're at Twin Peaks High School. And Bobby, he gets pulled into the office because, okay, so Bobby picks up Shelly and he's going to give her a ride home. Leo's there at the house. So Bobby skirts off, drops her off, and heads to school. Gets to high school. Bobby gets pulled into the office to talk to Sheriff Truman. And here we're introduced to Bobby's friend, Snake, Mike. And we also see characters, James Hurley, the vapid biker, and Donna Hayward, who was Laura's friend. And we also get this random guy dancing across the hallway, and we love him, right? Then we're introduced to Audrey Horn, who is Ben Horn's daughter. She shows up from her private transportation to school. She's not taking the bus. How do you think Ben's doing all this evil stuff? Why do you think he's doing it? So his daughter rides the public school bus? No. She shows up in the private transportation. She's at her locker. She's sneaking a cigarette in because it's the 90s, right? And she's changing out her shoes. She was wearing the black and white saddle shoes, and now she's putting on red heels, showing us more duality elements of personality, but it's also another homage to Wizard of Oz because Dorothy, of course, wears the ruby red slippers in the movie, not the book. The book is silver. And those saddle shoes were also very popular around the 50s, which is a time period that David Lynch loves. Although Twin Peaks takes place in 1989. But there's lots of 50s vibes coming from Lynch. Everyone at school, they're starting to sort of piece it together. Like, where's Laura? And it's almost like they know she's dead. And then the announcement comes out that she did, in fact, pass on. And there's a bit of overreacting, screaming. But her friends, James and Donna, they're sad, but in a way that you can tell they're not really shocked, which makes sense when you find out what Laura was going through from Fire Walk With Me and her secret diary. The principal even dismisses classes for the day because everyone shook up. This is the homecoming queen. She's dead in a horrific, brutal murder fashion. We never got sent home when anyone died. So this is a big deal. Now, what's really interesting here is that it feels like everyone projects how they think they know Laura from the principal to random students. Everyone's shook about this, including this terrifying, screaming girl running outside. A bit of an overreaction, but Lynch may have done this to indicate some kind of transition, some sobering waking up from childhood to, or adolescence, I should say, to adulthood. The end of an innocent period of life. In this school, they keep Laura's photo as the homecoming queen in the school trophy cabinet front and center. So it was a big deal in Twin Peaks. But certainly all these people didn't know Laura and her drives and motivations. So Bobby's in the library. He's getting interrogated because they think maybe he did it. He's her boyfriend after all. So back to the sawmill. Josie Packard, who's now the owner of the sawmill, she's fighting with Catherine Martell. Josie shuts down the sawmill because one of the workers, Janik Pulaski, found out his daughter is missing also. So now they're worried, like, oh, there's two dead girls now. But we find out in a minute here that Ronette, she's not dead. She's actually stumbling around some railroad tracks looking beat up, confused, and tied up in a real mess, okay? So drama ensues because Catherine, she's cold-hearted, man. She wants that sawmill to stay open and working. Josie shuts it down. And then Catherine, she she just fires a random guy who's walking past because she's so mad. Now, we're introduced to Big Ed, who's running Big Ed's Gas Farm. It's a gas station, and there's a sign on top that looks like an all-seeing eye. But you'll find out in the Secret History of Twin Peaks book, it's actually an egg, which I don't know how that makes sense. But we'll come back to this episode too. His wife, Norma, she's missing an eye. She's got the black patch over the eye. And she's always tripping on Ed, right? Always harassing the guy. And you find out why in the book. He accidentally shot her eye out when he was hunting, I think. So she's always been a little nutty, though, all right? So now we're at about the 36-minute mark, and we finally get introduced to FBI Special Agent Dale Cooper. He's driving to Twin Peaks. He's recording on his cassette recorder, raving about the Lamplighter's cherry pie, which has always confused me because after you watch the show, he's always raving about the Double R Diner's cherry pie. I'm not sure what that's about. So there's two cherry pies that'll kill you near Twin Peaks. Well, he's recording into this cassette recorder. He's talking to Diane, who's apparently his administrative assistant. But of course, when you hear Diane, you think of the moon goddess, right? The moon goddess of wisdom. And he's going to Twin Peaks because it turns out that Ronette Pulaski crossed state lines when she was stumbling around the bridge. So he meets up with Sheriff Truman, goes into the hospital room that Ronette is in, but she's a mess, right? And he starts inspecting her fingers with a magnifying glass. Everyone's like, what are you doing, bro? Now, fun idea about Agent Dale Cooper. It's possible, I would suggest, that maybe Dale Cooper is named after my first red pill daddy, Bill Cooper. I know people say that it's named after W.B. Cooper, the guy who disappeared or whatever. Maybe, right? But let's talk, maybe Bill Cooper, right? Let's throw that theory out there. Because he started talking about all these topics in the late 80s, published Behold a Pale Horse in 91. So it's hard to know for sure unless Frost and Lynch were really on the cutting edge of these topics, which we can argue they were. I mean, this show was basically written in the 80s, so, I mean, possible, right? So Cooper and Truman, they go to see... we already talked about that. He's looking for something under the fingernails, can't find it. Then, as they're leaving, this psychiatrist, Dr. Lawrence Jacoby, shows up and introduces himself. And he says, real creepy, he says, Laura was a patient of mine. And then he tells him that they had a relationship. And mind you, she's 17 when she died. And he's got to be in his 40s or 50s. And then he tells them that Laura's parents didn't even know that she was seeing him. So now she's got, apparently, two boyfriends. And he's doing all this while he's simultaneously playing with this tie that has a hula girl with a grass skirt, like a actual grass skirt on it. And you see his fingers going up the skirt. Very creepy. I'll put the photo on the Instagram. You can see what I'm talking about. So Cooper, he and Truman go to the morgue. There's lights flashing. They tell you it's because of a bad transformer. Electricity plays a role throughout Twin Peaks. And Cooper analyzes Laura's fingernails, I should say. And and he extracts a very microscopic letter from under her ring fingernail, and it's way down there, uncomfortably down the nail bed. He's inserting these tweezers, and he pulls out the letter R. And it's a notoriously queasy sequence for people to watch. It is kind of hard to believe this show was on ABC, to be honest. Later on, Cooper is reading Laura's diary because Truman confiscated her diary from the room and reads the last entry that she made, and it was about how there was asparagus for dinner and she didn't like it. Now, what's really interesting is that when you watch the missing pieces, you know, the deleted scenes from Fire Walk With Me, they play this exact scene of her hating asparagus at the dinner table, holding true to the storyline. But in the diary, she says she's nervous about meeting Jay tonight. So Cooper, he goes back in the diary to a different page that has a key inside of an envelope, and he tells Truman to run it for cocaine. And we also find out in Missing Pieces that she was, in fact, using that key along with cocaine. And Truman's like, no, dude, you don't know Laura. She wasn't doing coke. Because everyone thinks they know Laura. It's very strange. They're projecting what they want to believe about this woman. So they're interrogating Bobby next. And we see the video of Laura and Donna at a picnic, sort of dancing around. And they get the zoom in of Laura's eye, the all-seeing eye. Has Laura been exposed to the occult perspective? She indeed has, albeit forced upon her, and definitely not in the way that she would want to. Okay, so we're back at the Great Northern Hotel. Audrey Horne, she's feeling a little cheeky. She's about to blow the deal with the Norwegians when she informs them of the death of Laura Palmer. And, you know, we assume it's the deal falls through because Audrey tells them about Laura's death. But later you can also hear one of the Norwegians tell Ben Horn that everyone here has a gun. Not good. You know, referring to America, who is in fact strapped to the teeth. I heard an interesting theory the other day about how, I guess they said Switzerland is also armed at a similar proportion. I think Robert F. Kennedy said this. And he was suggesting it was Big Pharma and the antidepressants and crap that are doing it, because that's the big difference between Switzerland, you know, Swiss culture and American, maybe. So Cooper and Truman, they go to the crime scene in the railroad car, and they find half of a best friend's necklace and a note that says, "Fire Walk With Me," written in blood. So now they want to find the other half of the best friend's necklace. You know what I'm talking about? It's the golden heart, and it says best friends, and it's torn in half. So you give half to your friend. This is a very 90s thing. You keep one, and your friend gets one, and you wear them too. I don't know. Show everybody your best friends. Now, James Hurley, the biker, he actually has the other half of that, because we find out that Laura was also dating James Hurley. So there's three love interests now. And James would later bury it with Donna. We'll come back to that, right? So they go to the bank, Cooper and Truman, they go to the bank where Laura had a safety deposit box. That's what the key is for. And they open the safety deposit box, or they get it, and then they take it back to the sheriff's department. If I'm not mistaken, it's the scene where there's a big moose head on the table, and I heard that Lynch, they were actually still assembling the set or something like that, and that moose head, they were going to put it on the wall for the set, but they didn't get it done, and Lynch was like, no, let's just roll with that. So purposefully left there on the table. They open up the box, and they find a copy of Flesh World, which is like this smutty magazine. And they see ads in the back for women, escorts, and Ronette Pulaski's in there, circled. And then there's $10,000 in cash. Another classic Dale Cooper scene. He kind of gets a little too excited opening the Flesh World. He thumbs through the cash. He says, that's a lot of Girl Scout cookies. You know, showing us that this, reminding us that this is just a young girl still. So we get to this town hall meeting, right? Cooper holds the town hall meeting to discuss these crimes with the town because everyone's concerned. We meet most of the characters. We get a nice introduction to each one, a recap of who they are. We got the log lady. We got Josie Packard. We got Ben Horn. We got Catherine Packard, who's... Okay, so Josie Packard was married to a guy named Andrew Packard. Andrew started the town of Twin Peaks, by the way. Or the Packard bloodline. Or the Packard bloodline apparently started the town of Twin Peaks. And Catherine is Andrew's sister. Okay, that's her role in the Packard sawmill, but Josie owns the sawmill because she was married to Andrew when Andrew died. We've got Mayor Milford, who also, by the way, his brother Doug Milford is one of the most important characters in the story of Twin Peaks, but you don't even find that out until you read the books. He's barely in the show. So they have this sort of town hall meeting, and they talk about what's going on, okay? Then Donna is trying to sneak out of her house, and she sneaks out through her sister Harriet's bedroom window, and you see a birdcage prominently placed. Birdcages are symbolic of dissociative identity, mental abuse stuff sometimes, particularly of young women, whom are referred to as birds. Then we got Mike, Snake, and Bobby. They're drinking and driving. And this is one of the quirkiest scenes of Twin Peaks. They pull up to Donna's house because Snake is dating Donna, all right? But Donna is sneaking off to meet with James Hurley. What's going on there? So Snake and Bobby, they pull up to Donna's house. And Bobby, he's surfing on the hood of the car for whatever reason. Snake knocks on the door. He's like, I want to talk to Donna. But Dr. Hayward is like, hey, I don't know. Let's go see what's up. And Harriet snitches on her immediately. Says, oh, she rolled out the window. She left. So Snake and Bobby, they head to the Bang Bang Bar, the Roadhouse. Another classic setting in the world of Twin Peaks. And they're looking for Donna now. And it's a very lively bar, packed full of people in this very tiny town. So Mike gets in there and he grabs Donna. He sees her in there and he shakes her. And Big Ed steps in. He's an old Vietnam vet, you find out in the books. And this big bar fight ensues. And I think it's Julie Cruz is on stage singing the haunting melody. She don't stop. And Donna, she escapes with James. No, she escapes with a different biker who's going to take her to James. Because James, I don't know if he's in a bike gang. Seems like he is, but not really. So then we get this dialogue between James Hurley, Donna Hayward, and we find out that James says that, look, I was with Laura the night she died. And Laura was saying how she had this hidden side that nobody would understand. And she got into some really dark stuff. So I'm going to play this clip. It's pretty long, but it's an important dialogue because it sets up the narrative of the story.
James, they're looking for you.
I talked to them. But I think they're going to lock me up.
Why?
I don't have an alibi for last night. I was with her.
James, what happened last night?
It was kind of like a nightmare. Donna, she was a different person.
What are you saying?
I'm telling you, there were things she was involved with. Things she let herself get pulled into. Things she thought you'd hate her for. She said there are things about me. She said even Donna doesn't know me.
I knew her. I knew her better than she thought I did.
Donna? She said something about a guy getting killed.
Who?
She didn't say, but she said, Bobby that he killed this guy.
Oh my God.
This is why I had to see you. It all makes some kind of terrible sense that she died. That someone killed her. I don't know. I can't explain it. I didn't know whether to believe any of this last night. I mean, half the time she wasn't making any sense. I couldn't calm her down. I could hardly keep her on the bike. We came to the light at Sparkwood in 21, and she put her hands around my neck. And she screamed she loved me. I looked into her eyes, they were clear. It was like she was Laura again. She was so sad. She sounded so desperate. And she ran off. I let her go and she died.
It's not your fault, James. It's okay. James, it's all right.
That's why everybody hates James. He's got no loyalty, no integrity. He starts hooking up with his one day dead girlfriend's BFF. And we find out in this story, though, that Laura ran away from James. She got off his bike and ran away at Sparkwood and 21st, right after James was able to see in her eyes that it was her again, meaning it seemed like she was possessed. And as the story unfolds, you learn more about this. All the way up through season one, season two, and Fire Walk With Me. Now, Cooper and Truman, they pull James over, they arrest him, and now he's in the clink with Bobby and Mike. Oh, I think I forgot to tell you. So James and Donna, they're secretly talking in the forest, in the woods, and that's when we find out that James has the other half of the best friend's necklace. Donna says, look, they're looking for someone with the other half of that necklace. They think that could be the killer, so they bury it. All right. So then, and look, Donna, again, that all-knowing Sophia goddess, she knew, because right after this scene, Cooper and Truman, they pull James over and arrest him. So it's a good thing he buried that necklace. So now James is in the jail cell. So is Bobby and Mike, who are presumably in there because of the roadhouse fight. And Mike and Bobby, they start barking at James savagely, like animals. And James, he's staring at them. He's like a Neanderthal looking down his brow at them, sort of shaking. And then Cooper and Truman, they sit down at the sheriff's office. And it's about, it's 12:28 a.m. to be precise. And they sit down. There's about 50 donuts laid out on the table, an absurd amount of donuts. And even more absurd is that it's midnight. And these donuts are laid out for the next morning. These things would be so stale, right? So Cooper tells Truman, look, I got to stay a while. I got to find a place to stay. And Truman says, well, you got to stay at the Great Northern. Which turns out to be exactly what Cooper wanted. So he's in room 315. It's non-smoking. It's clean. It's reasonably priced accommodations. It's exactly what he wanted the whole time. Then the final scene, Laura's mother, Sarah, she's at home on the couch. She's having the vision of a person with a gloved hand retrieving that buried best friend's heart that James tried to hide. And she screams. She's got the most horrific scream. And you find out, you confirm later that she does in fact have this psychic connection with Laura. And in the final shot of the pilot, you also see a shot of Bob in the mirror, which synchronistically secures his role in the show as Bob. Or Frank Silva is his real name, I should say. Because as you know, he was a set designer. And through a sequence of synchronicities, David Lynch was like, no, you're now one of the most iconic villains of all time. So in conclusion, the pilot, of course, is really amazing. Everything centers around this photo of Laura as the homecoming queen. She's mythologized. Everyone's affected. Everyone loved her. Everyone thinks they know her. But she has this dark side, like James tells us about, and you find out throughout the show. And, of course, we love Dale Cooper, right? Very masculine in the most non-traditional way. But let's unpack Sheriff Harry Truman. I think that this name was chosen for a reason. A reason meant to unpack. Because President Truman, you even hear Dale Cooper say it when he's talking to Diane. He's like, oh, Sheriff Harry S. Truman. That's an easy one to remember. Because there was a President Harry Truman. And President Truman, he assigned James Forrestal to be the Secretary of Defense. And he, as the story goes, allegedly directed James Forrestal to establish the Majestic 12, the MJ-12, which is the first UFO task force. Well, Forrestal, he would eventually suffer from depression and mental illness, would get hospitalized at the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. They put him in a room on the 16th floor because they were actually trying to make him save face. They put him in a room that was not for mental illness patients. But bad move, right? Because back then, depression was considered very weak, apparently, right? In the 40s. So he jumps out the 16th floor window and left a suicide note, which is part of a poem, if you dig into this. And it's a translation of Sophocles' Ajax. Now, Ajax is a tragedy story about a Greek warrior named Ajax who wants Achilles' armor. Achilles dead. He's the greatest warrior. So now the second greatest warrior is supposed to get his armor. And Ajax is like, that's me, bro. Hand it over. But they don't. They don't hand it over. He goes on this killing spree, ends up feeling ashamed by his actions, and commits suicide by falling on his sword. And the implication here that Forrestal referencing that in his suicide note is that he is falling on his own sword. A common trope for the Roman and Greek warriors who, after defeat, would rather die. They'd rather commit suicide. The poem, I'm not going to read the whole poem, but it ends with the lines, "No quiet murmur like the tremulous wail of the lone bird, the querulous nightingale." Now, the Nightingale is one of the most iconic Twin Peaks songs sung by Julie Cruz on Twin Peaks. The song is called The Nightingale, and she performs it at the Roadhouse on this pilot episode while everyone's fighting. Now, the conspiracy theory is that Forrestal was murdered because he knew too much about MJ-12 and aliens and Roswell. He was, in fact, found with a bathrobe sash cord tied around his neck. And the location is curious because Bethesda, Maryland is home to the headquarters of Lockheed Martin, who is alleged to also be the defense contractors that have the Roswell and other fallen UFO craft. And this is multiple conspiracies going way back making this claim, including the most recent whistleblower, David Grush, who said that there were in fact agreements with aliens and the U.S. government and that defense contractors have the craft and they're the ones reverse engineering the technology so that the government doesn't have to disclose anything to the public because it's not a government entity. It's a private corporation, right? But yeah, massive conspiracy rabbit hole there. And of course, we also have President Truman, who was president while he was searching for the White House cornerstones that they, when they built the White House, they had found a bunch of stones with Freemason symbols on it. And they were given out to different lodges on the because Harry Truman was the 33rd president and he was also a 33rd degree Freemason. And I was watching the History Channel, a show called Unexplained with William Shatner. They had an episode about the founding fathers and they show us one of these cornerstones, one of these Freemasonic cornerstones that Truman directed to get dug up. And has a symbol on it, and I'll be damned if that symbol doesn't look quite similar to the Twin Peaks symbol found on the ring. Of course, it's not exact, but there's similarities there for sure, and I'm going to put this on the Instagram. So check it out. That particular stone was sent to the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C., which, as you know, when you listen to the America, what did I call the show? It was QAnon back in summer 2020, American Occult, QAnon. We talked about the Osiris resurrection ritual that they do at the House of the Temple in DC every inauguration. But yeah, the and of course Harry Truman, also the one who renamed Boulder Dam back to Hoover Dam. And Hoover also has this, there's a National Historic Site at West Branch, Iowa, at Truman's grave. And there's this creepy statue of what they call the Veiled Isis. And the National Park Service website says, Isis wears a veil, a symbol of the mysteries of life. Anyway, it's kind of creepy, but especially when you look at Bill Cooper's theories on his Mystery Babylon series. And we talked about this on the Wizard of Oz deep dives that we've done. The Osirian mysteries. Because Plutarch said Isis means knowledge. And Bill Cooper said Osiris and Isis aren't references to real people. They are symbolic, meant to conceal the esoteric wisdom of the great work of this one world government. And Isis symbolizes the Atlantis mysteries, the Church of the Mystery School. So all this stuff ties together, right? And I mean, you could take this as deep as you want to go with it, but it does. And there is this theme of sex magic. And if you go, okay, so if you go through the Mystery Babylon idea that Bill Cooper presents, he says Osiris is the doctrine, Isis is the church, the body of all initiates, and the Isis is the female, Osiris is the male. Okay. Well, the initiates, they're the body of initiates seeking the lost word, seeking the phallus, the penis of Osiris. And this all goes back to astrology, the original, the first occult science from the Babylonians. And the alchemists were using it to help decipher their art. But in astrology, there are 12 signs, and they're all related on the struggle of humanity's higher and lower nature. Again, that ascension, descension of consciousness idea, like you see when Leland Palmer drops the phone. Like the Sagittarius Centaur, or the sexual drives of Scorpio, the virgins of Virgo. Because sex magic is what all of this is all about. And when I first watched Twin Peaks, you know, that was one of the themes I got. I just kept getting this theme, and I was like, is that what this is about? And it seemed like all the females were very important on the show. They seemed to be the all-knowing Sophias. And you'll find out more, and we'll talk about this, I think, in the next episode. We go to One-Eyed Jax, which is the whorehouse. But a lot of this is related to the Scarlet Woman, and I would argue sex magic. And the books about Twin Peaks later confirm this in a way. You also hear that Laura is full of secrets. She is the Scarlet Woman. In fact, another theme in Missing Pieces, we hear the man from another place, who's the little man in the waiting room. He talks about going up and down between worlds and intercourse and electricity. And electricity, of course, is a duality of playing with positive atoms or positive you've got negative electrons. And the protons, right? So it's atomic action. But there's multiple layers in this show. And what you'll not realize is happening is that there are multiple layers happening at the same time. There's this sort of soap opera broadcast TV thing, safe for television, safe for the family idea. But underneath is pure horror that pops out every now and then, right? And then yet underneath that is an occult doctrine, paranormal activity. You know, it's a small town. People are in these relationships, but there's this hidden dark side. They're all cheating on each other. Look at Laura Palmer. She's the bubbly homecoming queen. Everyone loves her. But underneath, she's doing drugs and doing sex and hanging out with these dark characters. She's even seeing Dr. Jacoby, the psychiatrist who's at least 30 years older than her. And in the book, Twin Peaks book, you find out Jacoby gets his license revoked, so that's good, right? Sorry, I'm making a mess. Had to get a drink. okay. So the artwork for the first season, it shows Laura Palmer's face. Half of it is the homecoming queen. The other half of it is dead. So when you read your diary, it's obvious that this is one of the themes of Twin Peaks. She feels dead inside, so she becomes addicted to drugs and sex as a way to numb out. Why does she feel dead inside? Well, you're gonna find out why as the show goes on. And something else you don't realize that's going on is there's well thought out continuity here. Small scenes and statements will show up later in the film or missing pieces, and they fill in the blanks, like how Laura says she hates asparagus, like Laura getting off James's bike at Sparkwood in 21, or Laura hiding the key to her diary, which holds the baggie with a key and coke, and you've got this sort of double reference to cocaine, key and kilo, right? Or the, you know, my personal favorite is Bob speaking to Laura through the ceiling fan, and she gets this sort of possessed evil smile going on. And then, of course, you got all the duality, which, you know, we'll probably cover that deeper at some point. Everyone's got these sort of side affairs going on. It's like Carl Jung's shadow talk, or the idea of masks that we talk about often. Everyone's got two lives. They got the public and the private. Everyone seems real normal, but if you know, look into their hidden desires, their id, they're pursuing them actively in Twin Peaks. Donna, she's dating Mike, Snake. She's dating Snake and James. By the end of the pilot, she's dating James now. Big Ed is married to Nadine, but he's secretly dating Norma. Norma is married to Hank, who's in prison. Ben Horn, he's screwing everybody. He's married, but he's screwing everybody, including Catherine Packard. Sheriff Truman, he's seeing Josie Packard. Not really an affair, but scandalous nonetheless. Shelley's married to Leo, but she's dating Bobby. Bobby was dating Laura at the same time. Laura was dating everyone. It's a real mess, right? I mean, even the name itself, the name of the town, Twin Peaks, implies duality. But anyways, it's all meant to make you think of different realities, different timelines. And of course, the intelligence agencies are always intrigued and interested in the phenomenon, which is where the character Major Briggs will come in. They're always looking into this. And of course, there's other important occult aspects we'll get into as we continue in the Grey Lodge. Stuff that's not even in the pilot. The woods, the owls. And of course, the owls remind me of Bohemian Grove, which is where the Manhattan Project was conceived, which gave us the atomic bomb from Edward Teller, right? Which plays a critical role in season 3, as well as the Scarlet Woman, which is Laura, because she's full of secrets. So, because there's these Jack Parson elements of the story. And then big ones like demonic entities feeding off of fear, pain, suffering. It's called Garmin Bosia. We'll talk about that. Very similar to Adrenochrome. And again, this is from the 89, man. Way ahead of its time. So there you go. That was the pilot. That was a big one. And from here on out, we're going to go through the episodes. The episodes in season 1, there is going to be shorter episodes of the podcast. But then we're going to get through season 1. But I believe season 2 also has a really long first and last episode. Like, it's like a full-length movie. Like, this pilot was 90 minutes or whatever. So some of these episodes are going to be short. Some of them are going to be long. Then we're going to do Fire Walk With Me. That's going to be an incredibly long. That might be 2 parts. There's a lot to get through with that. But yeah, lots to come. Lots to come in the Grey Lodge. So I hope you're enjoying your time. Thank you for your support. And until next time, stay woke.